Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. It's a nightmare most parents never imagine, and thankfully never have to. But for Daniela and Solomon Barjona, a trip to the dentist with their four-year-old son, Junior, turned deadly.
At one point, you know, I did feel guilty.
To me, I thought, you know, it's every dental place is the same.
We had in the back of our minds at all times, you know, something so simple as taking him to a dental office had led to his death.
He was just very energetic, you know, everybody loved him.
Full of life, wanting to learn everything, wanted to know everything, broke everything. Of course, to us as his parents, he was everything.
Those are the voices of Junior's parents and their story, as well as the stories of others who've had family and friends die as a result of dentistry, are told in a multi-part series in the Dallas Morning News. The writer, Brooks Edgerton, is with us this hour. Brooks, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with the story of Junior. What happened after his parents took him to have his teeth looked at?
Well, they went first, as many parents do, to their general dentist, the family dentist. She said that he needed four teeth treated, with crowns put on. She didn't have the wherewithal, she thought, to keep him under control while she did that, and so she referred them to a pediatric specialist, and that's where they went. And Junior there was given a three-drug cocktail to drink, and he never went home again.
So he took this three-drug cocktail you outlined. I think it had Valium and narcotic painkiller. Was this standard drugs for a kid, a four-year-old kid, to take?
Well, it turned out from our research that while people might sometimes use this mixture, none of the three Texas dental schools approve dosages of those three drugs at the levels this dentist was giving them. He was running about twice what they approved. In fact, he had gone to one of those dental schools for both his standard four-year dental degree and his advanced training in pediatric dentistry. But for reasons he won't explain, he was using a stronger dosage.
So, and you gave this information, the dosage information, to an unassociated doctor. What did that doctor say?
He said that it simply did not meet the definition of moderate sedation, which is what it purported to be. Under moderate or conscious sedation, as it's sometimes called, the patient is supposed to become groggy, but not asleep, not knocked out, certainly not under what we would consider deep sedation or general anesthesia, capable of responding to direction, such as, you know, settle down or move this way, or and at any rate, our expert, one of the top dental anesthesia experts in the nation, just said he's outside the bounds of that definition. Another expert we talked to said he thinks that that many dentists who treat children are tempted to go beyond or to push the bounds of safe sedation practices, to get as close as possible to knocking the patient out.
Oh, interesting. And so because maybe kids are harder to handle to do work on their mouths, is that right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, young children, preschoolers, I guess is what we're talking about, certainly are going to be, you know, more difficult to keep calm. And obviously they need to be still because they're around sharp tools. But there are other categories of people as well, you know, developmentally disabled people or elderly people who, you know, may not have all their faculties any longer. Anybody who's struggling with self-control, perhaps just from, you know, from phobia.
So are drug overdoses like the one that happened with Junior usually fatal?
Well, the dosage that he received, no one that we talked to said they would expect it to typically be fatal. The problem when you're administering sedation to anyone is you generally don't know going in how they're going to respond, and there's a huge variability in the population. And one example we give in one of the stories is just, you know, think of yourself if you ever have gone out after work and had a drink and you haven't eaten since breakfast. You might get tipsy off of one beer. Some people will drink four beers and you notice nothing change about their behavior, and somebody else might have one. And so there's that. That's going to apply. And we have to remember that when people are sedated, typically they've been under fasting rules, you know, so as to keep down the risk of nausea during and after the procedure. So they're coming in on an empty stomach and given a heavy dose of something. Yeah. And somebody in that mix, you know, 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, who knows, going to react more strongly.
What happened when Junior was brought to the hospital? He stopped breathing.
Yeah, he stopped breathing in the dental chair, and it's unclear how quickly that was detected. He had a device on his finger that measured his pulse and his respiration. It came off at some point, and the dental records are not clear how long it was off, but when it was reattached, there was nothing. He was flatlining. At the hospital, it was kind of a lost cause, really. He wasn't breathing on his own for some minutes, and it was clear when he got there, you know, breathing with support only, that he had suffered brain damage, and he never recovered from that.
So, of course, this story, and it's just tragic to read and to see photos of and to hear. But what's worse than that is this isn't the only case. How often does something like this happen?
Well, this is something for all our research we're still struggling to know, because there's so much secrecy in the world of dental regulation. Every state has an agency whose job it is to test dentists, to license them, and to protect the public from bad ones. But almost all state agencies we've found are doing a poor job of tracking these cases. So there's very little information available. Texas turned out to be the only state we could find that was doing a decent job of it. And that's how we were able to come up with an estimate nationally of how many dental patients had died. We were able to determine that at least 85 had died in Texas since 2010, and estimating out, that takes us to about 1,000 deaths in the United States.
How exactly is dental training and certification different from the process of becoming a physician?
Well, for most dentists, there's a 4-year degree, as there is in medicine. But that training is typically not going to include anything in terms of pain management and anxiety management beyond the pretty basic tools that all of us are familiar with, local anesthesia, the numbing shots that you get in the gums, and perhaps nitrous oxide, the gas that will induce a very mild form of sedation if properly used. So during those 4 years, generally speaking, the dentist in training is not going to learn about heavier forms of sedation or general anesthesia. Some will go on to do advanced training and get quite a bit in that field, but the vast majority will not. But they are able to start sedating patients just by taking a few extra days of continuing education classes, essentially. Things that might be held, you know, in a hotel ballroom over a long weekend, and they pass fill out a form and get checked out briefly by the dental board in their state, and they're good to go.
Why are dentists allowed to be in that sense, sort of, to do anesthesia? Shouldn't there be someone else who's doing that?
Well, to be sure, you know, under some circumstances, physicians might be able to do the same thing. But typically, they work in circumstances that make it difficult for them to just go out on their own with anything. Physicians are much more likely, for example, to have connections to other physicians and to hospitals and other institutions that also serve formally or informally as a check on their any risky behavior they might be tempted to engage in. Dentists still, by and large, are outside that framework. I've heard people refer to dentistry as a cottage industry still. Many, many dentists are still practicing more or less on their own in individual offices, even with the rise that many of us have seen in corporate dentistry and chain clinics.
Are dentists performing more procedures or more risky procedures than they used to?
Well, I'm not aware of anybody who has hard numbers on this, but one journal article we cite in the recent coverage says that sedation is the fastest growing phenomenon in dentistry. More and more dentists are getting permits to sedate their patients. They're offering sedation for things as simple as cleanings. You know, we're not just talking about invasive procedures such as wisdom tooth extractions or gum surgery.
And what are most of these sedations? Say that my dentist offers me something for a cleaning. What will that consist of?
Well, there are probably 1,000 answers to that question, unfortunately. Everybody seems to be searching for the magic mix, and I don't know that anyone has it, and it may not exist. For you as a consumer, I just say, you know, I tell people now, you know, if you're thinking about sedation, it may be something that makes treatment much easier to tolerate. It may be a very good thing for you, but you may want to have a pre-visit to talk with the dentist about their level of training, who else will be in the room monitoring you, what kind of equipment will be available to monitor you, what dosages, what drugs. There are a lot of questions you'll want to think through.
It's typically not something you prepare before seeing a dentist, is a list of questions.
I'd never thought of this in my life before working on this story.
And now how often are you thinking about it or talking about it with people?
I'm afraid I'm thinking about it at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And you have children, right?
I do. I have a child. I couldn't help but think about my own son when I first heard Junior's story. You know, the thought of taking your child to the dentist and never going back home again is just staggering.
It is. And have you been to the dentist since?
I have, and so is my son. You know, we're fine. Yeah, we just think about things, and you know, we do our best to take care of our dental health, and you know, and to not need major dentistry. That's certainly one thing that everyone can do is, you know, be mindful of your own diet and hygiene practices. So, you know, and I tell people as well, don't just think of dentistry as a cosmetic thing. It's a gateway to
much larger procedures.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to get to more tips in a moment. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. And this hour, deadly dentistry. We're talking with reporter Brooks Edgerton with the Dallas Morning News about his investigation into dentistry gone wrong. You can call 800-933-5372 to join the conversation or email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Going to the dentist should not be deadly. Sometimes it is. And yet tracking down how often patients die as the result of a dental visit is extraordinarily difficult. That's what Brooks Edgerton found out when researching for his series in the Dallas Morning News called Deadly Dentistry. Brooks, of the deaths linked to dentistry in Texas, how many of these were kids versus adults?
Well, we aren't able to know those answers. We're just simply not allowed. The state has decided for us that we're not going to know that. We tried to get those basic questions answered, and initially the Texas Dental Board told us they would share the death reports that they had received from dentists, but they changed their mind. We filed a lawsuit, and we ultimately lost. So we don't have information that we all would like to have, except in a small handful of cases that led to discipline. Less than 10% of the cases go that route, and we don't know why. The state will tell you, not to worry, that most of those deaths were coincidental, essentially. They were dental patients and they died, but it didn't have anything to do with dentistry, but they won't show us details. Of the cases we do know about, the majority are adults. They don't necessarily have anything to do with sedation. And in addition to the deaths, another piece of this iceberg we're dealing with are unexpected hospitalizations of dental patients. We found something on the order of 500 people had to go to the hospital. For reasons not anticipated at the time of the dental treatment. And those cases are all over the place. Several people who nearly bled to death, for example, not a sedation issue at all.
What are the other reasons that people that you found have died either in dental offices or in the hospital after dentistry?
Well, in addition to just the straight-up overdose issue, there are other things that are sedation-related but aren't exactly blamed on the dosage levels. For example, poor monitoring of people under sedation can be deadly, or poor emergency response. Some people are going to have allergic reactions sooner or later to what you've given, and the question is, are you prepared for it? Some people are going to have a heart attack in the dental chair. It may be related to a medication that they received. Perhaps it's not. Perhaps they're cardiac patients who didn't have any business receiving heavy dental treatment outside of a hospital operating room. Or perhaps it has nothing to do with dentistry other than being afraid and being under stress and having the heart attack. And then the question becomes, well, how well prepared are America's dentists to deal with emergencies, including those that are not their fault? And one of the scariest interviews I did in the entire project was with a dentist in Ohio who teaches emergency response training to dentists. And he's basically come to the conclusion that most dentists in America simply are not capable at their current training level of responding to a major medical emergency. They may not have the proper equipment. They may not have a defibrillator in the office. They may not have extra oxygen so that they can bag you and breathe for you if you should stop breathing.
We're talking with reporter Brooks Edgerton with the Dallas Morning News about his investigation, and this was, an 18-month investigation into dentistry gone wrong. You can call and join the conversation or ask questions, 800-933-5372. Let's go to the phones where we reach George and Addison.
Hi. Very interesting topic. I'm glad to hear about it on the radio. I just went to the dentist recently, and he's really pushing for me to get my wisdom teeth taken out. I've got great teeth. I don't have any. The dentist before, in my past, said that they don't really pose an issue. They're not crowding the rest of my teeth. I was curious if there's a specific procedure or if there's certain things that I should be aware of going into, a major surgery. I want to reiterate, I'm not the least bit inclined to want to get my teeth taken out. So, I was going to see if you could respond to that. I'll take it off the air, and then thanks so much.
Thank you, George. And of course, you aren't a dentist or a doctor, Brooks, but you can certainly give your thoughts there.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the most common questions that people face. Young people or parents of teenagers are very, very frequently advised to have their wisdom teeth removed as basically as a preventive measure to prevent crowding of teeth in the future or to prevent infection in the future. There is a huge and fierce debate inside dentistry over whether this is a good idea to remove these teeth basically as a preventive measure. I'd encourage you to, you know, read up on that debate. It hasn't been widely covered in mainstream.
Hasn't.
Yeah, but the American Public Health Association, for example, thinks that it's a terrible idea. The Oral Surgeons main professional association thinks it's generally a good idea. And it's more than I can get into here to sketch out the arguments on each side, but I think the basic idea from the American Public Health Association is there are risks with any surgery, including the risk of the risks that go with sedation. And on the oral surgeon side, you're going to hear that as you get older, the risks get higher, and infection can spread in your mouth and. But definitely read up on that. And also, if you're going to be put under all the way, make sure you know the training level of the person who's doing it and who else is in the room helping oversee you.
Now, the series that you reported, Deadly Dentistry, it has photos, it has videos, it has graphics. And the first image on the landing page is of this little boy, of Junior, and he's in the image. It's a drawing on his deathbed. It's disturbing and yet impossible to look away from. But I have to ask whether by putting an image of a kid on the landing page, on the front page, so to speak, it's possible you could be scaring parents from bringing their kids to get their teeth cleaned or examined.
Well, we certainly don't want to scare people away from dental treatment. It's, fear is a powerful motivator, I guess, in both directions. It can inspire us to do stupid things and to change our behavior for the better. We certainly do not want to come across as advising people to avoid dental treatment. It only drives up the risks that you'll face down the road.
I mean, was it tricky, though, as a journalist, wanting to draw attention to this very disturbing and yet rare issue of death by dentistry? How did you draw that line, or was it tricky for you to not fearmonger, but yet to make sure people understand this?
We just decided, I think, at the end of the day, that it's such an unfamiliar concept that that we had to get down to the stark reality of it. There are other images in the series that are perhaps as disturbing, and I'd love to hear what your listeners think about some of those as well. They don't stand out in quite the same way, but there's a picture of a dental patient whose face was set on fire, and another dental patient who was blinded in one eye by a stray needle. They're all really hard to look at, and yet they're so unfamiliar that we felt that we should show them so that people do understand the stakes.
Yes, and the response from readers, what has it been?
Well, one of the most interesting things to me is how many dentists I've heard from, almost exclusively from dentists who are glad that we did the series and felt that this was an issue that wasn't being addressed, that people needed to know about the problems in their profession that had largely been kept under the rug. I've also heard from some emergency physicians with similar expressions of finally somebody is focusing attention on this, and talking about the number of patients they see coming into hospitals from dental clinics.
Whether you're a dentist or a patient, you can join the conversation with Brooks Edgerton on his investigative series, Deadly Dentistry, in the Dallas Morning News. You can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go to Chad in Dallas.
Hi there. My question would be, in your intro to the segment, you said that this four-year-old was told by his dentist that he needed to have four crowns. I find that a little hard to believe that a four-year-old was needing to have crown work done, as they're probably going to lose their teeth anyhow. How, in your investigation, did you find any evidence of, like, over-prescription of treatment or unneeded treatment? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
Well, to make it even more startling, while this child's family dentist recommended four crowns, the pediatric specialist recommended 12.
Oh.
And they were going to, so he was going to be seeing the pediatric specialist twice to do six at a time. I don't have a good answer for you, I'm afraid, as to whether these were good recommendations or not. You know, I'm not a dentist, and I'm not in a position to evaluate. But I know what you mean. It's a startling idea, and I think there are different schools of thought out there about whether excessive treatment is being prescribed for little people who, you know, have their baby teeth still, after all, and they are going to fall out. I know some people will argue that if you don't deal with the dental infection, which is essentially what has occurred in the tooth, that you're creating problems down the line and creating the possibility of worse things happening. And then there are other people who I think feel very strongly that people are being billed for unnecessary treatment.
You tell the story, Brooks, of two casino workers in Las Vegas who suffocated after being sedated. What happened to the dentist who was responsible for that?
Well, Nevada stopped him from sedating anybody else, but he also had a license here in Texas at the same time. And so he carried on in our state with no restriction whatsoever, no one apparently being the wiser. He filled out a form at one point where he was asked in renewing his Texas license whether he had been disciplined, and he checked no. He told me that that was an accident, one of those just things that happened when he was filling out a form online. And he has since had his license suspended in both states. But for a number of years, he's been working in the Houston and Austin areas as if these deaths in Las Vegas had never occurred.
And what about the doctor who treated the four-year-old boy? Were you able to track him down?
I'm sorry, the dentist. Yeah.
I guess it's still a doctor of dental surgery.
Yes. Yeah, so it's okay. He is still practicing in the Dallas area. He shut down the office that he was running near Love Field, where this child was overdosed, and he quit taking Medicaid patients. And he reopened in one of the nicest shopping plazas, Preston Center in Dallas.
Which agencies are supposed to be regulating dentistry in Texas?
Well, the Texas State Board of Dental Examiners is sort of your primary agency, and there's an equivalent agency in every state. That's their job, is to monitor dentists. There are other agencies that may play secondary role as well. Health departments in some states have become deeply involved in regulating dentists after it turned out that dentists were not using proper sterilization techniques. There have been a couple of huge scandals in recent years, one in Colorado, one in Oklahoma, in which dentists were found to be reusing syringes. In one case, a patient was confirmed to have contracted hepatitis from that practice. Thousands and thousands of patients, however, got letters advising them to be tested for AIDS or hepatitis. I can't imagine getting that letter in the mail.
No, I can't imagine getting that either. It's really not something you'd think about. You mentioned that you sued the board, the Texas board, in late 2014, trying to get records. You still haven't gotten anything, right?
That's right. Yeah, I don't understand why the state, if they're not going to turn over these records, doesn't at least publish a detailed accounting of what is in them with everybody's name kept anonymous.
Is it how other states behave, or do you see a difference here?
There are a few states that were willing to turn over these patient harm and death reports to us. A tiny percentage of states were willing. When we did see these reports, sometimes we would see considerable timidity, in my opinion, from the state regulators. I remember a case from Maine, which is one of the most open states. But it didn't, they were open, but that openness didn't inspire any confidence, I guess I would say. There was a record from a dentist who disclosed that a patient of his had fallen unconscious or unresponsive after receiving a local anesthetic injection. And he didn't call 911 for about 10 minutes. And the dental board's only response to this was to say, well, in the future, if you have a patient who falls unconscious, you might want to call 911 a little faster.
We have to take a quick break here. We're talking with Brooks Edgerton with the Dallas Morning News, his multi-part series, Deadly Dentistry. You can call and join the conversation, 800-933-5372, or email think@kera.org. We'll be back after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman. In today for Chris Boyd, we're talking about Deadly Dentistry. It's a multimedia series that appeared in the Dallas Morning News and dallasnews.com, written by Brooks Edgerton. Brooks, I imagine that people listening want to know what to look for when choosing a dentist or how to review the dentists they currently see. What can you tell us?
Well, in Texas, I'd say the agency does, the Texas Dental Board does a pretty good job of keeping disciplinary records available online indefinitely and in a fairly easy to find form. Every state has some kind of list on its website of licensed dentists, and the majority of those states will indicate it at least whether they have a disciplinary history or not. And many of the states will provide a link to the actual disciplinary records. I'd encourage everybody to read those. If your dentist has a disciplinary history, it certainly doesn't necessarily mean they're dangerous. It may have been a minor problem, or it may have been something that they've corrected. But I have read thousands of these disciplinary orders from around the country over the past year and a half, and I'm still stunned at some of the things I've seen. So you definitely want to do that reading.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Randy in Garland.
Hello.
Hi, Randy. What's your question?
Yeah, my name's Randy, and I'm here in the near future due to tooth loss through my life experience and the love of chocolate, probably. I'm going to have to do something and have the rest of my teeth pulled out and get either dentures or implants. Now I've been referred to possibly Baylor School of Dental School which I know they have students kind of work on you, I guess, at different levels of their experience. I'm not really nervous about doing that because I've had Parkland, the Southwest College, put my eyeball back together, and they did a real good job over there. But my two-part question is there anything that I should know going into this, going to the Baylor School of Dentistry, and does the Parkland Southwestern College have a dental program that would help me out with that? And I'll hang up a little.
Thanks, Randy. I'm sure you get lots of these specific questions, Brooks. What can you say at least about the dental school question?
Well, Parkland and UT Southwestern don't have a dental school, but they do have people who are training in oral surgery, which is sort of at the highest level of training for a dentist. The question there would be, you know, how well trained are they, and you know, what kind of supervision will they have? And that'll be true at any academic institution where you're having work done. I don't have any specific opinions about Baylor or the Parkland UT Southwestern training programs in dentistry, but I would encourage you to ask questions about the level of training of the person who's going to be doing the work and what kind of supervision they'll have from someone who is a fully licensed a dentist or doctor.
Let's take another call. Let's talk with Monica in Dallas.
Hi.
Hi, Monica.
Am I on?
Yeah.
Hi. I just wanted to bring this up. I had a root canal about 20 years ago, and that I was new in town, got referrals, went to a dentist, hadn't really had a lot of experience with major procedures. And he drilled through my sinus cavity, which he tried to say, nothing happened. And I said, yeah, there's something that's not in my mouth anymore, you know. And I got a horrible infection. He gave me antibiotics, but I didn't want to go back to finish the procedure. So I called my dentist from high school and asked if I could come in there, and he wouldn't see me. And then I started calling local dentists here in town. I was going to go to Houston. Nobody else would see me because they wouldn't take the liability. Mm. I had to go back to the guy to get it to finish it because nobody else would finish it. And I had this open thing in my mouth. And I didn't understand why no one would help me out. And then finally the guy finished it. And then when he put the crown on, he starts drilling on my other teeth to even it out. And I left. I said, stop it. I'm done with you.
Wow.
I literally got out of the chair before he was done trying to even glue it on. And since then, you know, I've found a good dentist, but I rigorously researched it. But I was just freaked out that nobody else would help me out of the situation. And I'm hoping that's changed. But that was my comment.
Thanks. Thanks, Monica. And that brings up a really good point and question is what happens with liability, medical liability and lawsuits, Brooks? What did you find in terms of people trying to sue?
Well, we found a huge disconnect between the malpractice world, where people have received compensation typically in out-of-court settlements, a huge disconnect between that world and that of the discipline by the state agencies. In one case, the most stark example was New York State. More than 30 patients had died and had payments made to their survivors. None of those cases led to discipline by the New York State dental authorities, which generally means that the public has no way to know, especially if these were out-of-court settlements. You can't even go look it up in court records. So you're going to be the patient coming in behind somebody whose patient has died and whose insurance company has paid $1 million to the survivors, and you know you're the next patient to be treated. And we have found cases where you know one dentist had more than one patient die. So it's I think it's a scary thing. As to the caller's point, I've heard this story and I've seen this in records numerous times where drilling accidents have led to perforations of sinus cavity or other injuries in and around the mouth, you know, ranging from, you know, wounds, burns. And I've heard from many patients that same difficulty in finding someone else. You know, if you become afraid of your provider, what do you do if something has gone wrong? And there are, I'm sure a lot of dentists are nervous about taking that on. Sometimes it may be because they're sympathetic with the original dentist, and sometimes it may be that they're not clear on what has gone wrong, and they may be afraid that if they get involved in treating, that they could end up being blamed for something that had already been done improperly the first time.
And you even write in the series quite a moving story about a dentist who does something that you refer to, or I don't know if it's called that in the industry, as drilling while intoxicated.
Yeah, this was another one that I have to say never crossed my mind before, but I was stunned at how many cases I found around the country where people had been who were working while drunk or high or both. We found one guy who had injured his patients with, you know, drilling while intoxicated, and after a series of rehab experiences had finally gotten clean and was willing to talk to us about his journey to sobriety. Some of the other cases were even more terrifying than his. They weren't merely drilling accidents, but in one case in Oklahoma, a dentist was found to have been over-sedating people while he was high himself. And, you know, I can't imagine somebody who's not in their right mind administering deep sedation.
You can join our conversation. You can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We're talking with Brooks Edgerton, reporter with the Dallas Morning News, about his investigation into dentistry. Let's go to the phones now, where we have Coral in Plano. Hi, Coral.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. So my question is, with all of these fatalities that you guys have found, could a preventative dental made a big difference? I mean, there was a four-year-old who had four crowns. At that point, to me, that shows parental neglect. Is in any of the other cases, was that found to be a possibility?
All right, let's see there.
Yeah, the other cases other fatalities in Texas that we know about have mostly been adults. And I'm trying to think off the top of my head what some of the scenarios were. In some cases, we were not allowed to know many details. The records of the state were very sketchy. One case I can think of off the top of my head, the adult patient had an immune system deficiency. I can't think of the name of the condition, not AIDS. At any rate, she was someone who was extremely susceptible to infections, she died shortly after dental treatment from a massive infection. This is something that has happened to other people as well who were in perfect health going in, and the level of suspicion that the patient or their family or the dentist had about a post-surgical infection was pretty low. But people have died after having, you know, an infected wisdom tooth removed. There's one dentist we wrote about here in Dallas. They had two patients came back to him with severe post-surgical infections. He didn't take it seriously. He didn't refer them to an emergency room. Both of them wound up in the hospital. One of them nearly died.
There's someone wrote in, Clint writes that he's listening to the broadcast, and in response to the question about why a four-year-old would need caps, he says, my daughter was four, and due to her having no tooth enamel, her teeth were decaying. Even though we brushed her teeth very well twice a day, our options were to pull out her teeth or have caps put on. And he writes, we did not want her being toothless for years as we waited for her adult teeth to come in, so we chose to have the caps put on. That could be one explanation for why a four-year-old might get mini caps. I don't know if you've heard that, Brooks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a variety of conditions that don't necessarily have to do with poor dental hygiene in the home that could lead you know, to the need for serious dental work. So I don't want to pass judgment on anybody's hygiene, although I think the caller's point is also well taken. All of us, you know, need to be aware of our diet and our brushing and flossing habits, and
definitely always good advice. Are there also sort of good takeaways or ideas for how regulations could be changed or openness of records? What are you now, after having spent 18 months and countless nights, as you mentioned, thinking about this, what are you hoping changes?
Well, it seems to me if the state is going to give somebody a license to use heavy sedation, and the state has the right to inspect your methods and premises before giving out those licenses, that they should actually be doing that. And we found in Texas that hasn't been happening. So people go and get their long weekend of training to use major drugs to put people almost under or near all the way under, and but nobody's really checking on them to see, you know, if they're doing it appropriately. So that's certainly one thing that could change, that there would be just a higher level of scrutiny. I think, you know, sunshine is a great policy. So if the state is not going to release the records of these deaths, then certainly they should release a report that summarizes what's in them. You know, what were the... So we would know, what are the ages of these patients? What are their underlying health risks, if any? Were they sedated? What was the actual cause of death? Many of the reports that I was able to get where discipline did occur, there still wouldn't be any reference, say, to an autopsy report. Even in this case in Dallas, where the medical examiner clearly found that the child had died of a drug overdose, there's no reference to that in the disciplinary order. So if you come upon it independently, you might read this and think, well, you know, maybe it was an overdose, maybe it wasn't.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd, and we've been speaking with Brooks Edgerton on his multi-part interactive series in the Dallas Morning News. It's really worth checking out. It's called Deadly Dentistry. Brooks, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knabe. Lindsay Knecht is associate producer, with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. And you can contact us via email anytime, think@kera.org. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.